Side 9, Inversions by Ian M. Banks. Continuing on page 327. He ran quickly, bare feet thudding on the wooden boards. He pulled his shirt on as best he could. He was looking for a guard to tell him to follow him, but there were none to be seen. Rounding a corner that would take him towards Latin's sick room, he crashed into a servant carrying a breakfast tray, sending the girl and the tray tumbling across the floor. He shouted back an apology. There was a guard at Latin's door, slumped asleep on a chair. Diwar kicked the seat and shouted at the man as he burst through the door. The nurse looked up from the window where she had been sitting reading. She looked with widened eyes at Diwar's bare chest revealed by the half-tucked shirt. Latin's lay still in his bed. A basin and a cloth lay on the table by his head. The nurse seemed to shrink back a little as Diwar strode across the room to the boy's bed. Diwar heard the guard come in behind him. He turned his head briefly and said, "Hold her," and nodded at the nurse, who flinched. The guard moved towards the woman, uncertain. Diwar went to Latin's side. He touched his neck and felt a weak pulse. Clutched in the boy's fist was the pale yellow scrap of material that was his comforter. Diwar prized it from his hand as gently as he could, turning to watch the nurse as he did so. The guard stood at her side, one hand clamped over her wrist. The nurse's eyes went wide. Her free arm flailed at the guard, who kept a hold of her and eventually succeeded in grabbing it and bringing it under control. She tried to kick him, but he twirled her round and forced her arm up her back until she doubled over and screamed, her face level with her knees. Diwar inspected the sucked end of the comforter while the guard looked on, mystified, and the woman gasped and wept. Diwar sucked tentatively at the piece of material. There was a taste. It was slightly sweet and a little acrid at the same time. He spat on the floor, then knelt down on one knee so that he could look into the nurse's reddened face. He held the comforter in front of the woman. "Is this how the boy's been poisoned, madam?" he asked softly. The woman stared cross-eyed at the scrap of material. Tears and snot dribbled down her nose. Her jaw was clenching and unclenching. After a few moments, she nodded. "Where is the solution?"
Under the window seat," the nurse said, her voice shaking.
"Hold her there," Diwar told the guard quietly. He went to the window and threw off the cushion in the seat set into the thickness of the wall, pulled open a wooden flap and reached inside. He threw aside toys and a few clothes until he found a small opaque jar. He brought it over to the nurse. "Is this it?" she nodded. "Where does it come from?" She shook her head. He took out his long knife. She screamed, then shook and struggled in the guard's grip until he tightened it and she hung gasping again. Diwar put the knife very close to her nose.
"The Lady Perrand!" she screamed. "The Lady Perrand!"
Diwar froze. "What?"
"The Lady Perrand! She gives me the jars! I swear!"
"I am not convinced," Diwar said. He nodded to the guard, who forced the woman's arm further up her back. She shrieked in pain.
"It's true! The truth! It's the truth!" she screamed.
Diwar sat back on his heel. He looked at the guard holding the woman and shook his head once. The man relaxed his hold on the nurse again. The woman sobbed, her whole doubled-up body shaking with the effort. Diwar put the knife away and frowned. Another couple of uniformed men came thundering into the room, swords readied.
"Sir,"
said one, taking in the scene. Diwar stood.
"Guard the boy," he told the pair who had just entered. "Take her to Guard Commander Zespiol," he instructed the man holding the nurse. "Tell him Latins has been poisoned, and she is the poisoner."
Diwar tucked his shirt in as he strode quickly towards Erlane's apartments. Another guard, also alerted to the commotion, came running up to him. Diwar sent him off with the man taking the nurse to Zespiol. There was one guard at Erlane's door. Diwar drew himself up, starting to wish he had taken the time to put on all his clothes. He had to see Erlane no matter what orders he might have left, and this guard's help might be needed to effect entry. He assumed what he hoped was his most commanding tone.
"Straighten up there!" he barked.
The guard jerked upright.
Is the Protector inside? Diwar demanded, scowling and nodding at the door.
No, sir, the guard shouted.
Where is he?
Sir, he went to the harem, I think, sir. He said you need not be informed, sir.
Diwar looked at the closed door for a moment. He began to turn and move away, then stopped.
When did he go there? About a half bell ago, sir.
Diwar nodded, then moved away. At the corner, he started running. Two more guards joined him when he called them. They headed for the harem. The double doors to the three-domed receiving room slammed back against the walls on either side. There were a couple of concubines in the softly lit hall, talking to members of their families and sharing a light breakfast with them. All fell silent when the doors crashed open. The chief eunuch, Stike, sat like a sleepy white mountain in his pulpit raised near the middle of the room. His face cleared of sleep, and his brows met and creased as the doors swung slowly back from their twinned impact. Diwar sprinted across the room towards the doors leading to the harem proper, the two guards trailing in his wake.
No! Bellowed the chief eunuch.
He rose and started to wobble down the steps. Diwar reached the harem doors, wrenching at them. They were locked. Stike came lurching over the floor towards him, wagging his finger.
No, Mr. Diwar, he cried. You do not go in there. Not ever in any event, but especially not when the Protector himself is in there.
Diwar looked at the two guards who had followed him. Hold him, he told them. Stike screamed as they tried to take hold of him. The eunuch was surprisingly strong, and each of his leg-thick arms knocked over the guards once each before they could secure him. He cried out for help as Diwar tore at his white robes, looking for and finding the set of keys he knew was there. He cut the keys from the struggling giant's belt, tried one, then another, before the third key slipped in and turned, and the doors opened.
No!
Wailed Stike, almost pulling himself free from the two guards. Diwar looked around quickly, but there was nobody else who could help. He pulled the key out and took the full set with him as he entered the inner harem. Behind him, the two guards struggled to contain the mighty rage of the chief eunuch. Diwar had never been here before. He had, however, looked at the layout of the place on drawings, so knew where he was, even if he did not know where Erlane was. He ran down a short corridor to another set of doors, Stike's anguished cries and entreaties still ringing in his ears. There was a round internal courtyard beyond, gently lit by a single translucent dome of plaster high above. The glowing space rose on three colonnaded levels. A small fountain played in the center, and couches and seats were scattered about its floor. Girls in various states of dress and undress stood or doubled up where they lounged, yelping and screaming when they saw Diwar. A eunuch leaving a room off to one side of the lowest colonnaded level saw him and shouted. He waved his arms and came running up to Diwar, slowing and stopping only when he saw that Diwar held a sword.
"The Lady Perrand," Diwar said quickly. "The Protector."
The eunuch stared as though hypnotized at the tip of the sword, for all that it was a couple of strides away from him. He raised one shaking hand towards the pale dome above.
"They are in," he said in a quiet, shaking whisper. "The topmost level, sir, in the small court."
Diwar looked around and saw the stairs. He ran for them, then in a spiral up them to the top. There were 10 or so doors arranged all around the highest level, but across the well of the courtyard he could see a wider entrance which formed a truncated corridor with double doors at its end. He ran, breathing hard now, round the gallery to the short hallway and the twinned doors. They were locked. The second key he tried opened them. He found himself in another domed internal courtyard. This one had but a single level, and the columns supporting the roof and the translucent plaster dome were of a more delicate turn than those in the main court. There was a fountain and a pool in the center of this yard, too, which at first sight appeared to be deserted. The fountain was in the shape of three intertwined maidens, delicately sculpted from pure white marble. Diwar sensed movement behind the pale carvings of the fountain. Behind this, on the far side of the court, beyond the columns, one door lay ajar. The fountain splashed, tinkling. It was the only sound in the wide, circular space. Shadows moved on the polished marble of the floor near the fountain. Diwa glanced behind him, then walked forward and round. The lady parent knelt before the fountain's raised pool, washing her hands slowly and methodically. Her good hand massaged and wiped at the wasted hand, which lay floating just under the surface of the water like the limb of a drowned child. She was dressed in a thin gown of red. It was semi-transparent, and the light from the glowing plaster dome above fell down across her disheveled blonde hair and picked out her shoulders, breasts, and hips within the gauzy material. She did not look up when Diwar appeared round the side of the fountain. Instead, she concentrated on washing her hands until she was satisfied. She lifted the wasted limb out of the water and placed it gently by her side, where it hung limp and thin and pale. She rolled the flimsy red sleeve down over it. Then she looked slowly round and up at Diwar, who had approached to within a few steps, his face pale and terrible and full of fear. Still she did not say a word, but looked slowly round at the door which lay open behind her, opposite the double doors through which Diwar had entered. Diwar moved quickly. He pushed the door open with the pommel of his sword and looked into the room. He stood there for some time. He backed away until his shoulder hit one of the columns supporting the roof of the room. The sword hung loose in his hand. His head lowered until his chin rested on the white shirt over his chest. Perrin watched him for a moment, then turned away. Still kneeling, she dried her hands as best she could on her thin gown, looking at the rim of the fountain's bowl, a hand or so in front of her eyes. Suddenly Diwar was at her side, standing by her wasted arm, his bare feet by her calf. The sword came slowly down to rest on the marble rim of the fountain's bowl, then slid with a grating noise near to her nose. It dipped, and the blade went under her chin. The metal was cold on her skin. A gentle pressure lifted her face until she was looking up at him. The sword remained pressed against her throat, cold and thin and sharp. "Why?" he asked her. There were, she saw, tears in his eyes. "Revenge, Diwa," she said quietly. She had thought that if she could speak at all, her voice would quiver and shake and quickly break and leave her sobbing. But her voice was steady and unstrained. "For what?" "For killing me and my family, and for raping my mother and my sisters." She thought her own voice sounded much less affected than Diwar's. She sounded reasonable, almost unconcerned, she thought. He stood looking down at her, his face wet with tears. His chest was coming and going inside the loosely tucked and still unbuttoned shirt. The sword at her throat, she noticed, did not move. "The king's men," he said, his voice catching. The tears continued to stream. She wanted to shake her head, though she was worried that the slightest movement would cut her skin. But then he would be doing that soon enough anyway, if she was lucky, she thought. And so, tentatively, she did shake her head. The pressure of the sword blade across her throat did not waver, but she avoided cutting herself. "No, Diwa. Not the king's men. His men. Him. His people. He and his cronies. Those closest to him." Diwa stared down at her. The tears were fewer now. They had made a damp patch on the white shirt below his chin. "It was all as I have told you, Diwa. Except that it was the protector and his friends, not one of the old nobles still loyal to the king. Erlane killed me, Diwa. I thought I would return the compliment." She opened her eyes wide and let her gaze fall to the blade of the sword in front of her. "May I beg you to be quick, for the friends we once were?"
"But you saved him!" Diwa shouted. Still the sword barely moved.
"Those were my orders, Diwa."
"Orders?"
He sounded incredulous.
"When what had happened to my town and my family and to me had happened, I wandered away. I found a camp one night and offered myself to some soldiers for food. They all took me, too, and I did not care, because I knew then that I had become dead. But one was cruel and wanted me in a way I did not want to be taken, and I found that once one was dead, it was very easy indeed to kill. I think they would have killed me in return for his death, and that would have been that, and perhaps the better for all of us. But instead, their officer took me away. I was brought to a fortress over the border in Outer Hospitus, mostly manned by Quiance's men, but commanded by forces loyal to the old king. I was treated kindly, and there I was introduced to the art of being a spy and an assassin.
Perrin smiled. If she had been alive, she thought, her knees on the cold, white marble tiles would be hurting a little by now. But she was dead, and so they troubled somebody else. Diwar's face was still streaked with tears. His eyes stared, seeming to bulge in their sockets.
"But I was ordered to bide my time by King Quiance himself," she told him. "Erlane was to die, but not at the height of his fame and power. I was commanded that I must do everything I could to keep him alive until his utter ruin had been contrived."
She gave a small, shy smile and moved her head fractionally to look at her wasted arm.
"I did. And in the process I became above suspicion."
There was a look of utter horror on Diwar's face. It was, she thought, like looking at the face of somebody who had died in agony and despair. She had not seen or wanted to see Erlane's face. She had waited until, having been given the news she claimed to have been called away to receive, he had fallen into a fit of sobbing and buried his face in the pillow. Then she had risen, lifted a heavy jet vase in her one good hand, and brought it crashing down on the back of his skull. The sobbing had stopped. He had not moved again or made a further sound. She'd slit his throat for good measure, but she had done that while straddling his back, and still she had not seen his face. "Quiance was behind it all," Diwar said. His voice sounded strangled, as though he had a sword at his throat, not she at hers. "The war, the poisoning."
"I do not know, Diwar, but I imagine so."
She looked deliberately down at the sword blade.
"Diwar?"
She looked up into his eyes with a hurt, pleading expression.
"There is no more I can tell you. The poison was delivered by Innocence to the Pauper's Hospital, where I received it. Nobody I know knew what it was or what it was for. If you have the nurse as well, you have the totality of our conspiracy. There is no more to tell."
She paused.
"I am already dead, Diwar. Please, if you would, finish the job. I am suddenly so weary."
She let the muscles supporting her head relax so that her chin rested on the blade. It, and through it Diwar, was now taking all the weight of her head and its memories. The metal, warm now, dropped slowly away from beneath her, so that she had to stop herself falling forwards and striking the rim of the fountain pool. She looked up. Diwar, his own head hanging down, was sliding the sword back into its scabbard.
"I told him the boy was dead, Diwar," she said angrily. "I lied to him before I crushed his filthy skull and slit his scrawny old man's throat."
She struggled to her feet, her joints protesting. She went to Diwar and took his arm with her good hand.
"Would you leave me to the guard and the questioner? Is that your judgment?"
She shook him, but he did not respond. She looked down, then grabbed at the nearest weapon, his long knife. She pulled it from its sheath. He looked alarmed and took two rapid steps backwards, away from her, but he could have stopped her taking it, and he had not.
"Then I'll do it myself," she said,
and brought the knife quickly up to her throat. His arm was a blur. She saw sparks in front of her face. Her hand began to sting almost before her eyes and mind had registered what had happened. The knife he had knocked from her hand smacked into a wall and fell with a metallic clatter to the marble floor. The sword hung in his hand again. "No," he said, moving towards her. Epilogue. It strikes me, having written this, how little we can ever know. The future is by its very nature unfathomable. We can predict a very little way into it indeed with any reliability, and the further we attempt to see into what has not yet happened, the more foolish we later realize we have been, with the benefit of hindsight. Even the most obviously predictable events, which seem the most likely to occur, can prove fickle. When the rocks fell from the sky back when I was a child, did millions of people the previous evening not believe that the suns would rise as usual, on schedule, the following morning? And then the rocks and the fire fell from the sky, and for whole countries the suns did not rise that day,
and indeed for many millions of people they would never rise again. The present is in some ways no more sure, for what do we really know about what is happening now? Only what is happening immediately around us. The horizon is the usual maximum extent of our ability to appreciate the moment, and the horizon is far away, so events there must be very large for us to be able to see them. Besides, in our modern world, the horizon is in reality not the edge of the land or the sea, but the nearest hedge, or the inside of a city wall, or the wall of the room we inhabit. The greater events in particular tend to happen somewhere else. The very instant that the rocks and the fire fell from the sky, when over half the world woke up to chaos, on the far side of the globe all was well, and it took a moon or more before the sky darkened with unusual clouds. When a king dies, the news might take a moon to travel to the furthest corners of his kingdom. It might take years to travel to countries on the far side of the ocean, and in some places, who knows, it might slowly stop being news at all as it travels, becoming instead recent history, and so barely worth the mentioning when travelers exchange the latest developments, so that the death that shook a country and unseated a dynasty only arrives centuries later as a short passage in a history book. So the present, I repeat, is in some ways no more knowable than the future, for it takes the passage of time for us to know what is happening at any given moment. The past, then? Surely there we can find certainty, because once something has happened, it cannot unhappen. It cannot be said to change. There may be further discoveries which throw a new light on what has happened, but the thing itself cannot alter. It must stay fixed and sure and definite, and therefore introduce some certainty into our lives. And yet how little historians agree. Read the account of a war from one side and then from the other. Read the biography of a great man written by one who has come to despise him, then read his own account. Providence talked to two servants about the same event that same morning in the kitchen, and you may well be told two quite different tales, in which the wronged becomes the wrongdoer, and what seemed obvious from one telling seems suddenly quite impossible given the other. A friend will tell a story which involves the two of you in such a way that you know it did not happen so at all, but the way he tells it is more amusing than the reality, or reflects better on the two of you. And so you say nothing, and soon others will tell the story, altered again, and before long you may find yourself telling it the way you know for a certainty it simply did not happen. Those of us who keep journals occasionally find we have, with no malice or thought of tale or reputation enhancement whatsoever, remembered something quite erroneously. We may, for a goodly part of our lives, have been giving a perfectly plain account of some past occurrence, one that we are quite sure of and seem to remember very well indeed, only to come across our own written account of it, recorded at the time, and find that it did not happen the way we remembered it at all. So we can never be sure of anything, perhaps. And yet we must live. We must apply ourselves to the world. To do so, we have to recall the past, attempt to foresee the future, and cope with the demands of the present. And we struggle through somehow, even if in the process, perhaps just to retain what we can of our sanity, we convince ourselves that the past, present, and future are much more knowable than they really are, or can ever be. So, what happened? I have spent the rest of a long life returning to the same few instants without reward. I think there is not a day when I do not think back to those few moments in the torture chamber of the Palace of Epherns in the city of Haspid. I was not unconscious, I am sure of that. The doctor only convinced me that I was for a short while. Once she had gone and I had recovered from my grief, I became more and more certain that precisely the amount of time which I thought had passed then had passed. Rollinge was on the iron bed, poised to take her. His assistants were a few steps away, I cannot recall exactly where. I closed my eyes to spare myself the awful moment, and then the air filled with strange noises. A few moments, just a handful of heartbeats at the most, on that I would stake my life. And there they all were, the three of them, violently dead, and the doctor already released from her bonds. How? What could possibly move with such speed to do such things? Or what trick of will or mind could be employed to make them do such things to themselves? And how was she able to appear so serene in the moments immediately thereafter? The more I think back to that interlude between the deaths of the torturers and the arrival of the guards, when we sat side by side in the small, barred cell, the more sure I become that she somehow knew that we would be saved, that the king would suddenly find himself at death's door, and she would be summoned to save him. But how could she have been so calmly certain? Perhaps Adlaine was right, and there was sorcery at work. Perhaps the doctor had an invisible bodyguard who could leave egg-sized bumps on the heads of knaves and slip unnoticed behind us into the dungeon to butcher the butchers and release the doctor from her manacles. It almost seems like the only rational answer, yet it is the most fanciful of all. Or perhaps I did sleep, swoon, or become unconscious, or whatever you like call it. Perhaps my certainty is misplaced. What more is there to tell? Let me see. Duke Ulrisil died in hiding in Brotican province a few months after the doctor left us. It was a simple cut from a broken plate, they say, which led to blood poisoning. Duke Quetel died soon afterwards, too, from a wasting disease which affected all the extremities and turned them necrotic. Dr. Skellim was unable to do anything. I became a doctor. King Quience ruled another 40 years in exceptionally good health until the very end. He left only daughters, so now we have a queen. I find this less troubling than I would have thought. Lately they have taken to calling the queen's late father Quience the Good, or sometimes Quience the Great. I dare say one or other will have been settled on by the time anybody comes to read this. I was his personal physician for the last 15 years, and the doctor's training and my own discoveries made me by all accounts the best in the land. Perhaps, indeed, one of the best in the world, for when partly due to the ambassadorship of Ga'an Kudun, more frequent and reliable links with the archipelagic republic of Drazen were established, we discovered that while our Antipodean cousins rivaled and indeed even exceeded us in many ways, they were not quite so advanced in medicine or indeed anything else as the doctor had implied. Ga'an Kudun came to live amongst us and became something of a father to me. Later, he became a good friend and spent a decade as ambassador to Hospitus. A generous, resourceful, and determined man, he confessed to me once that there was only one thing he had ever set his wits to that he had failed to accomplish, and that was trying to track down the doctor, or indeed hunt down exactly where she had come from. We could not ask her, for she disappeared. One night in the Sea of Osk, the plough of the seas was running before the wind past a line of small uninhabited islands bound for Kuskari. Then the glowing green apparition that mariners call chain fire began to play about the rigging of the ship. All were at first amazed, but then they became in fear of their lives, for not only was the chain fire brighter and more intense than anything the sailors could recall seeing in the past, but the wind increased suddenly and threatened to tear the sails, bring down the masts, or even turn the great galleon over entirely. The chain fire disappeared as suddenly as it had arrived, and the wind fell back to the strong and steady force it had been before. By and by, all but those on watch returned to their cabins. One of the other passengers remarked they had not been able to wake the doctor to come to see the display in the first place, though nobody thought much of this. The doctor had been invited to dine with the vessel's captain that evening, but had sent a note declining the invitation, citing an indisposition due to special circumstances. By the next morning it was realized she was gone. Her door was locked from the inside and had to be forced. The scuttles were screwed open for ventilation, but were too small for her to have squeezed through. Apparently all her belongings, or at any rate the great majority of them, were still there in the cabin. They were packed up and were supposed to be sent on to Drazen, but unsurprisingly they disappeared during the passage. Ga'an Kudun, hearing all this, like I, nearly a year later, became fixed upon letting her family know what had happened to her, and what good she had done in Hospitus. But for all his inquiries on the island of Naphthelia, and in the city of Prusel, including some which he made himself on a visit there, and despite the numerous occasions when he seemed on the very brink of discovering her nearest ones, he was always frustrated and never did find anybody who had actually met or known the woman we knew as Dr. Vosil. Still, I think that was one of the few things that irked him on his deathbed, and there was in balance an extraordinarily influential and productive life to look back on. The old guard commander at Lane suffered badly towards the end of his allotment of seasons. I think what consumed him was something like the growing disease that had taken the slaver Tunch all those years earlier. I was able to alleviate the pain, but in the end it became too much for him. My old master told me, he swore truly, that indeed, as I had always suspected, he had been the officer who had rescued me from the wreck of my home and the dead arms of my parents in the smoking ruins of the city of Durla, but that he had taken me to the orphanage in a fit of guilt, for it had been he who had killed my mother and father and burned their house. Now, he said, from the clawing depths of his agony, I would want to kill him. I chose not to believe him, but I did what I could to hasten his end, which came peacefully less than a bell later. His mind must have been going, of course, for if I had believed for a moment what he had told me, I think I would have been tempted to have left him to suffer. Also, before he died, Adlaine begged me, knowing he was on his deathbed, to tell him what had really happened in the torture chamber that evening. He tried to joke that if Quience had not turned the questioning chamber into a wine cellar shortly after the doctor left us, he might have been tempted to have me interrogated there, just to discover the truth. I think he was joking. It saddened me to have to tell him that I had already, in my reports to him, told him everything that had occurred to the limit of my recollection and descriptive ability. I have no idea whether he believed me or not. And so I am old now, and will lie on my own deathbed before a few more years are out. The kingdom is at peace, we prosper, and there is even what the doctor would, I think, have called progress. To me fell the immense privilege of being the first principal of the Medical University of Hasped. I also shouldered the happy duty of being the third president of the Royal College of Physicians, and later served as a city councillor when I was in charge of the committee overseeing the construction of the King's Charitable Hospital and the infirmary for the freed. I am proud that one of such lowly birth was able to serve his king and his people in so many different ways during a time of such improvement. There are still wars, naturally, though not recently in the vicinity of Hospitus. Even yet the three so-called empires dispute, though with little result save to leave the rest of the world free from imperial tyranny, and so able to thrive in its own various ways. Our navy seems to fight sea battles every now and again, but as they are usually far away, and we are as a rule victorious, it is as if they do not really count as warfare. Going further back, the barons of Ladentian had to be taught that who helps them resist one ruler might take it ill when they attempt to forego all rule. There was civil war in Tassassin, of course, following the death of the regicide Erlane, and King Yetamidus proved a poor leader, though young King Latins, well, he is not so young any more, I admit, but he still seems young to me, made good most of the ill, and rules well, if quietly, to this day. I am told he is something of a scholar, which is no bad thing in a king, providing it is not taken to excess. But that was a long time ago. All of this was. The tale of the concubine parent, which forms the counterpoint to my own, and which I have included here with almost no amendment, save where her taste foundered occasionally on the skerries of overly ornate prose, I searched out myself, after reading a version in the form of a play which I discovered in another bibliophile's library here in Hasped. I chose to end her tale where I did, because it is after that point that the two versions diverge most violently. The first version I read, in the guise of a drama in three acts, had the bodyguard Diwar running the lady through with his sword to revenge his dead master, and then returning to his home in the half-hidden kingdoms, where he was revealed in his true identity as a prince who had been spurned by his father due to an unfortunate but honorable misunderstanding. A deathbed reconciliation, decorated with pretty speeches, was effected with the expiring king, and Diwar reigned well thereafter. I admit I found this the more morally satisfying ending.
The version which purported to be by the lady's own hand, and which she claimed she only committed to paper to counter the sensationalized untruths of the dramatic edition, could hardly have been more different. In it, the bodyguard whose trust she had just violated, and whose master she had most cruelly done to death, took her by the hand from which she had barely finished washing their master's blood, and led her out of the harem. They told those waiting nervously outside that Erlane was well, but sleeping deeply at last, as though he already knew the cause of the boy's illness had been discovered. Diwar said he would take the concubine Perrin to Guard Commander Zespiol's offices to confront the nurse who had accused her. Falsely, he suspected. Diwar apologized to Chief Eunuch Stike and handed him back his keys. He told some of the assembled guards to remain where they were, and the rest to go back to their normal posts and tasks. He led the Lady Perrin away, politely but firmly. They were seen leaving the palace by the groom who supplied them with mounts, and observed leaving the city by a variety of honest citizens. It was about the time they were galloping through the city's northern gate that Stike tried to open the doors into the small court on the topmost level of the harem. The key would not fit properly into the lock, in which something appeared to be lodged. The doors were broken down. The foreign body which had been inserted into the lock after the doors had been secured proved to be a piece of marble in the shape of a little finger, broken from one of the maidens in the fountain in the center of the raised pool in the little court. Erlane's body was discovered in the bedroom off the court. His blood saturated the sheets. His body was quite cold. Diwar and Perrin were never caught. They made their way, after unrecounted adventures, to Mutaloksi in the half-hidden kingdoms, where Diwar, surprisingly, was not known at all, but which he knew a great deal about, and where he rapidly established a good name for himself. The two became merchants, and later founded a bank. Perrin wrote the account from which I have taken half my story. They married, and their sons, and allegedly their daughters, too, continue to this day to run a trading enterprise that supposedly rivals that of our own Mifeli clan. The company's symbol, reportedly, is a simple torus, a ring, such as might be cut from one end of a hollow pipe. This symbol is one half of what I suspect is not the only set of correspondences within and between these two tales, but considering the implications of these far too bamboozling for this old head to encompass, I have left it to the reader to discover their own points of similarity, draw their own conclusions, and blaze their own trails of speculation. At any rate, Diwar and Perrin, we are told, both died in the mountains in an avalanche in a mountain pass 5 years ago. The snow and ice of the unforgiving peaks is their only tomb, but as they died after what appears to have been a long and happy life together, I beg to repeat that I prefer the former version of their fates, even if it is not supported by any facts whatsoever. And now I think my divided tale is finished. I am sure there is much I have not said, much that could justifiably have been added had I only known a little extra, discovered a trifle more. But as I have indicated above, sometimes, indeed, probably always, one simply has to make do with what there is. My wife is due to return soon from the market. Yes, I'm married, and I love her now as I always have, for her own sake, not for that of my lost love, even if, as I will admit, she does look just a little like the good doctor. She took two of our grandchildren with her to look for presents, and they will expect me to play with them when they come back. I do little real work now, I am so old. But still there is a life to be lived. End of Inversions by Ian M. Banks. IAINMBANKS